This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of October the 12th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. There are now 22 days until Election Day. Although voters across the country are well on their way to breaking records for early voting, both by mail and in person, Hoosiers have been able to vote in person since October the 6th, and the turnout in central Indiana has been staggering. Should we expect anything different from a year that can charitably be described as unpredictable? Some of the biggest races on the ballot in central Indiana have been unusual as well. I don't need to tell you about the presidential race. In the governor's race, although Indiana is a Republican stronghold, I don't think anyone predicted Governor Eric Holcomb would be so far ahead of Democratic challenger Woody Myers, at least in the latest polls, which I think we've learned to take with a healthy dose of salt. Nor would we have expected the Libertarian candidate, Donald Rainwater, to make such a big impression. Meanwhile, the 5th congressional district race between Republican Victoria Spartz and Democrat Christina Hale is one of the most closely watched congressional contests in the country and has been declared by many to be a toss-up. IBJ's Lindsay Erdody, who covers state government and politics, has been writing about these races for months. In the latest issue of IBJ, she has an in-depth analysis of how well Governor Holcomb has fulfilled his promises and made progress on his priorities during his first term. She joins us for this week's podcast to discuss her findings, as well as the latest election developments, as thousands of Hoosiers head for the polls. And we're joined by Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, to provide his statewide perspective. Here's our conversation. For our discussion today, I am pleased to welcome to the IBJ Podcast Virtual Studio, Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne. Andy, thanks so much for making time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I am very happy to welcome back Lindsay Erdody, who covers state government and politics for IBJ. She's also the author of The Rundown, our weekly e-newsletter dedicated to politics. If you don't get it, go to IBJ.com. You'll see a link for newsletters on the upper left-hand side. Lindsay, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So we got a lot of ground to cover. Let's pretend that we are in a debate and you have a 45-second shot clock for your answers. And please, no interruptions. Very quickly, just for my own interest, really, and because it's top of mind, I want to mention the vice presidential debate from last night. Everybody who's listening, note that we're taping this on Thursday, October the 8th. And I'll ask both of you, what was the most consequential thing to come out of that debate? Or what do you think will be the most lasting effect of that debate?
Well, I think the most talked about thing today, at least, has been about the fly that was on Mike Pence's head. I don't know if that's what the takeaway should be, but I think that's what's gotten a lot of attention on social media. The other thing that's come up a lot is how much the candidates didn't actually answer the questions that they were asked. And to me, that's not that surprising. Maybe I just have a low bar for debates at this point, but I thought it was still a decent exchange of ideas and discussion on policy, even if they weren't answering the exact question they were asked. They were still talking about their positions on certain issues and policies that either administration would pursue.
I personally think the fly did nothing more than buy folks like Lindsay and me time to think about what it is we did want to say when answering questions like this. But when it comes down to it, Lindsay's right. A lot of people have been talking about the fact that the candidates, they weren't even close to answering the questions that were asked. But let's keep in mind that campaigns do an awful lot of polling and focus group discussions. So they know what messages are resonating with the voters. The people who are moderating debates don't necessarily know that, but the campaigns want to make sure they stay on message. The real art form is being able to take that question and turn it into something that the voters, do want to hear. And last night, there was not a lot of art form going on in that regard.
Is there any way, Andy, have you seen any kind of, debate format in which you are able to press the candidates effectively on a particular question?
What has to happen is the moderator has to be empowered in a way that is, some would say, actually disrespectful to the candidates. where the moderator can actually be so blunt as to say, you didn't answer the question. You still didn't answer the question. Mm-hmm. And moderators are always going to be slow to do that, because if they're doing that more to one side than the other, they're going to be blamed, or they're going to be called biased in one way or another. And in the end, as long as the people who are listening are getting substance out of it, is it so awful that the specific question is not getting answered? This goes back to Lindsay's point. We actually heard a fair amount of substance. Now, we can argue about the accuracy of the substance and the utility of it and those sorts of things, but there was substance there still. And so in some respects, who sort of cares what the question is? Now, I say that wishing that questions were answered more often, because I think they're good questions. But I get why it happens.
Now, I want to stay on debates, but move to the governor's race here in Indiana. There are two gubernatorial debates scheduled, one on October 20th, the other on October 27th. But Hoosiers have been able to vote at least since Tuesday. I mean, certainly the in-person voting. Hundreds of thousands of people could cast their ballots before the debates. I mean, how does that happen? What's the utility?
It's just kind of how elections work these days with so much early voting. And that's why you see, you know, in our publication that we've been trying to get out our election stories earlier. I think other news outlets have done the same. You try to inform voters the best you can as somewhat early as you can without doing it too early to where those people who are going to vote on election day forget all about anything you've ever written about the candidates. But I do think there will still be plenty of voters voting on election day. So those debates are still going to matter to some extent. And the people who are voting this week or next week probably already had their minds made up. And I'm not sure a debate was going to change their mind one way or the other.
I was trading emails earlier today with the election administrator, the executive director of the election board here in Allen County. And one comment she made was that voters are not taking a lot of time at the booth when they're there. They're walking up, they're pressing a few buttons, and they're getting out. So they are very much knowing what they want to do. There's not a lot of pondering when they get there. The research does show that there is a trend to people wanting to use early voting, and that excludes the COVID element to this. We know that more and more people are doing this. There's been sort of a nice constant upward tick in early vote participation. And it has helped to expand the electorate a little bit. But a lot of the people who are voting early are people who would have voted anyway. They're simply taking advantage of the convenience. So, you know, that's good. It means people are getting out there. The folks who encounter an issue when they get there, their voter registration maybe is not quite right. They're able to work out those issues. If they see a long line, they can come back later. So, you know, there's a convenience element to it that's good. And typically, you know, the last 2 weeks of an election is where a decent percentage of people actually make up their mind. This year, at least in terms of the presidential race, things seem to be baked in a little bit more. We have a smaller segment of the population undecided. And also, let's keep in mind that as far as the gubernatorial race goes this year, we are seeing kind of an unusual one in that the Libertarian candidate is advertising. We may actually see television ads from the Libertarian candidate and not from the Democratic candidate. So the fact that the debates are happening on the 20th and 27th, I think they're still meaningful, especially for those folks who are waiting to vote until later on. But Lindsay's right. The election day is election month now, and folks who provide information have to think about doing it in a way that helps people out over that entire month.
That's a great segue, because I wanted to talk about the Democratic campaign. Lindsay, we've talked in the past about how Dr. Woody Myers seems like an excellent candidate. He does on paper. He has a distinguished career in public health and in business. He simply has not made much of an impact in this campaign. What has happened with that campaign?
Well, I think what's happened is it just never really gained the traction that it was going to need to make a dent in this race. And I think part of that is you also haven't seen Holcomb make any mistakes along the way that would have helped the Woody Myers campaign gain some more momentum. He's had some moments here and there that he's gotten a little bit more attention. You know, we did a press conference this week talking about how he thought Governor Holcomb was wrong to move us to stage 5 and how we needed to go back. To be determined whether or not he continues doing that or we see more of that. And I also don't know at this point how much of an impact that's going to make on the race. He has said that TV is not his top priority. So to Andy's point, we might not see him on TV at all. We might see the Libertarian candidate on TV if he's not already. Some of the polling that we've seen has kind of put him in this 20 to 30% range all along for months now, and it really hasn't moved.
I know that we had talked earlier about the trouble that the Myers campaign was having raising money. Is that still an issue?
Absolutely. Yeah. You can look at the large donations that are coming in for all the campaigns, and the Libertarian candidate, Donald Rainwater, has taken in some of those while Dr. Woody Myers really has not. And Governor Holcomb pretty consistently has some of those large donations trickling in.
Isn't it a little disingenuous to say that TV isn't a priority? I mean, isn't that sort of like an existential issue for a campaign, Andy? I mean, how can you not have a gubernatorial race without being on TV?
When we talk about campaigning, we talk about the different methods of communicating, and we talk about television, radio, and social media, direct mail, all these sorts of things. And a rule of thumb has always been that you need to dominate one, but you kind of need a presence in all of them, or people may not think you're a legitimate campaign, as long as we're talking about a campaign of some size. So you can say television's not a priority, but you need to have a television presence. You can say direct mail is not a priority, but you need to have a direct mail campaign. At this point, there's a question of whether or not you'll even have commercials, television commercials from Woody Myers. And so I don't know that I'd use the term disingenuous, but I would certainly say for those who watch campaigns, they're likely to say that's not the sign of a particularly healthy campaign, especially since that's still, for a lot of campaigns, the number one way to spend your money. Television's not inexpensive when you think about needing to advertise in Indianapolis and the other markets, let alone hoping to have something on air in Northwest Indiana where you're paying Chicago rates.
And so we mentioned Libertarian candidate Donald Rainwater, I think last week. The big news was that he had raised a surprising amount of money, at least for a Libertarian candidate. He launched a robust radio campaign. He was very serious about trying to get a commercial on air. What's behind the rise in his campaign, Andy?
For me, and Lindsay kind of touched on this earlier, that Woody Myers has always sort of been stable in terms of polling, that, you know, that 20 to 30% range. If you look what's happened with Governor Holcomb's numbers, he's actually come down, depending on how you want to look at polling numbers. The other way to think of it is Donald Rainwater's gone up, and he seems to have pulled very much from the Republican side. Now, this is what we speculate most of the time anyway, that Libertarian candidates will draw from Republican candidates. But I think part of what happened here is that when the Myers campaign started to get serious, that's when we started to run into hunkering down, and that made it difficult to campaign. It made it difficult to raise money. And then also, we basically every day got to see Eric Holcomb doing things that look pretty good from a functional standpoint. He was holding these press briefings. He had experts present. He let the experts speak. He was clearly the one still making decisions. So he looked very gubernatorial in what he was doing. And I think that made a lot of Democrats think, maybe I'm okay with this guy. And Woody Myers hasn't had a great campaign, so why should I make my political investment there? But in doing things the way Holcomb did, he managed to upset some people who are more conservative than him. And I think that's where a chunk of Rainwater's support is coming in. So what I think you might be able to say is we're seeing a bit of a fracturing of the Republican, or at least the conservative vote, between Holcomb and Rainwater, and Democrats not being able to galvanize behind anything. If you look historically, Democratic candidates who spend very, very little money running for things like superintendent of public instruction or attorney general, treasurer, auditor, those sorts of things, they can expect to get 30 to 35% of the vote. If he's able to pull that off, and this is what I find interesting, if he's able to get to that amount, and if Holcomb and Rainwater really split what's left, we could have a very interesting close race. But clearly, since nobody is making those large contributions to Myers, there's not a lot of belief that that 35% is going to be enough to win. And if it were, money would be flowing to him and we'd be seeing him on television.
Let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
Okay, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast. We're talking with IBJ's Lindsay Airdoty and Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, about the big races and surprising developments in the election now underway.
So normally at this point in a gubernatorial race, I would think that we'd see a robust critique of the incumbent's specific accomplishments and failures, but it doesn't seem like we're getting that from the Myers campaign. So Lindsay, in a story in this week's IBJ, you took Holcomb's main objectives and promises over the last 4 years and then distilled them into 30 measurable commitments. Then you did the research to see if he accomplished or made progress on these 30. Can you first give us an overview of the kinds of priorities that he has had over his first 4 years?
Yeah, so I think it's worth noting he's definitely made more than 30 goals and promises over the 4 years, but that's what we focused on. I kind of distilled it down to some of those that were a lot easier to say yes or no, he has or hasn't done this or met this. A lot of them are focused on areas like economic and workforce development, education, infrastructure, education. Those are kind of the main topics that we looked at. And it's some of the things I would say most people probably have heard him talk about. I think about finishing I-69. That's been a state priority for many years now. Growing regional cities initiative and having more collaboration among communities. Making the workforce development more aligned with business needs. That was an early priority for him and continues to be something he talks a lot about. Healthcare is another one I should have mentioned. And in that one, I think the one we hear him talk probably the most about is lowering the state's infant mortality rate. And he has made some progress in that, although his goal is to be the lowest in the Midwest by 2024. And it is only 2020, but we are not there yet, despite the progress that we've made. But, you know, another one in that area was raising the tobacco age from 18 to 21 and reducing smoking rates. We have increased the age to buy tobacco, but we have not lowered the smoking rate. Back in terms of infrastructure, another one that, you know, our readers in particular might be interested about was securing more direct and international flights, which really had been going well, and then the pandemic hit. So you have to keep that in mind. So for the most part, looking at these 30, he has made progress or accomplished all but six of them.
And where are the six where he really just didn't make an impact?
So those include building the state's fourth port on the Ohio River. We just saw the state announce the site that they had planned to use for that. They decided it wasn't feasible. Governor Holcomb has said he is still interested in that, but the state hasn't found a new site for it yet. I mentioned lowering the smoking rates. The state hasn't seen that happen yet. Lowering obesity rates is another one that has not improved. It's actually gotten slightly higher since 2016. Improving the high school graduation rates also has not happened. And the other two were regional cities. As I had mentioned, Governor Holcomb wanted to grow that program. And instead, in the last budget, we saw there was no more funding for that available. And another one with workforce was the requiring businesses to provide the basic accommodations for pregnant workers. And that bill died in the Senate last year or the year before. But Governor Holcomb has said he will continue to pursue that.
Do we need an asterisk here for his accomplishments, saying that he had super majorities in both chambers of the legislature? Or did he accomplish some of these in spite of having a super majority of Republicans in the legislature?
There's something that I've been talking about for a number of years now. And I actually give a fair amount of credit to Long and Bosma for not trying to get everything done in a year or 2 years or even 3 or 4 years. They have taken a somewhat measured approach to things. Now, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of people who dislike what they were pushing in terms of their agenda. But think of what they could have crammed through. If you really think of what a legislature could get done, they really could have crammed some stuff through with supermajorities and Republican governors. But they didn't. I think they understood that there's an appetite for work and for things getting done. But there's a point where people say, wait a minute, we've gone too far. Let's slow down a little bit. And I think they recognized that and they worked within that. I think the change in leadership, we're seeing a similar sort of thing happening. Now, having said that, I will say that when you have a supermajority, if your batting average is not really, really high, then people can say there's something wrong. You're out of step with your party, or your party's out of step with you. Take your pick. So, yeah, I think some people could be critical. But when you look at some of the issues where success was not found, lowering the rate of smoking, obesity, those are really about individual actions. And I think there are a fair number of people in this state who would say, yeah, smoking's not good for you, but that's personal choice. And, you know, high fat diet and being so many pounds overweight's not good for you, but that's personal choice. So it's going to be hard to get some legislators behind something that is viewed as an individual problem. Whether it is or not is a whole nother discussion. And then after that, the improvement in graduation rates, well, we did kind of have a bit of a pandemic in there, and we had a problem switching over to iLearn. And so my point is, you can explain away several of the things that did not get done. Still, they didn't get done with a supermajority, but it's easy to come up with an explanation for it.
Is he lacking a signature accomplishment, something that generally everybody can point to as a touchstone for administration?
See, maybe it's just because of where, you know, I work at a university, so I pay attention to certain kinds of things. But if somebody asked me to define what I thought he wanted his signature to be, I would actually say workforce development. Once again, that could be because of where I am. He seems to put a lot of emphasis on that, got a little bit cross with his party and with the legislature at one point because of his efforts on workforce development. But I'd say that's it. And I, you know, unfortunately, workforce development's not, it's not one of those really exciting things. You're not cutting a ribbon on a new port. You're not finishing 69 with workforce development, but it is the sort of thing that makes a significant difference in terms of business attraction.
I would tie economic development in there too, because he talks about that all the time, and not just with me as the Business Journal reporter, but with other reporters as well, and in speeches. And, you know, just earlier this week when he was doing a gaggle with reporters, he was talking about attracting more jobs to the state, and that is, and he's hit records certain years in his administration doing that, and hit records with the wages that those jobs brought or promised to bring. I think that's also a top priority for him. Whether or not that's a signature accomplishment, I think you can debate that still. But we'll see what happens, you know, if he has a second term.
So I want to move to the 5th Congressional District race between Democrat Christina Hale and Republican Victoria Spartz. So we're going to send somebody to Washington to replace House member Susan Brooks, who has opted not to run. I'm kind of disappointed in myself because I really do want to revel in the horse race here, because it appears to be very close. What are we seeing in the race right now?
The race is interesting. The polling information that's come out, a chunk of it has been from organizations with a vested interest. So we have to take the results with a grain of salt. But we need to keep in mind also that the people who do polling don't want to be known as people who do bad polling. So there's something to be said for the results. And they show a close race. I think that's a reasonable expectation, in part because we have two candidates who've been pretty well funded to this point. We have two candidates who have experience running for office, but we have two candidates who have been willing to engage with one another. It's a district that I think people still think of as leaning Republican. I think that's probably still true, although the demographics are shifting in a way that suggests Democrats may be able to have some success. And Christina Hale, because she was, we'll say, relatively far ahead during the primary, was able to begin campaigning to independent voters sooner than Victoria Spartz was. And I think that has helped her out. I think that it's probably still a pretty close race. I know it continues to get national attention, not necessarily the way we have seen for some other races in the state in terms of resources, but people understand that it's a race to watch, and one that it would be dangerous to make too heavy a prediction, I think, at this point.
Do we have any idea how much money has been spent on ads in that race? At certain times of the day on local TV, it seems like they are the only advertisers.
Well, they both have raised over $1 million. I mean, loaned or received as contributions over $1 million. And television is where you're going to spend a lot of it. So I've not called around to see what the buys are, but we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I would say it's easily in the millions at this point, just when you factor in all the outside groups and what we know has already been announced. And, you know, it is a difficult thing to track through FCC records unless, you know, a campaign or an organization is telling you how much. But, you know, I kind of went through what we already know has been publicly announced, and we're easily above $3 million.
Do we have a sense of what this will come down to? Is that possible to say at this point? Like, what could make a difference at this point in that race?
The trite answer that I always give is get out the vote. You got to get your people to the polls. And that's when I say that, I always feel bad saying it because I could say things that were much more obvious than that. Not really. For me, this is a matter of, I think, Christina Hale being able to get people to be willing to split their ticket. And that's a complicated message because in some respects, you're almost telling people to disregard the rest of the people running from your party. And that upsets the other people who are running, which means they may not work with you quite as much when you're trying to, you know, coordinate walks and literature drops and those sorts of things. But for me, that's really the key for her. How does she get people to split the ticket? Sparks, I don't think, needs to do that. I think Sparks can, I don't say win on a straight ticket vote election, but it's less of an issue for her. But then again, she did have to run a ways out to the right. So she's had to sort of reintroduce herself to soft R's and independents.
As I mentioned at the top, Hoosiers have been able to vote in person since Tuesday. They'll basically have a month to vote for Election Day. Do you have a sense of how it's going so far, what the turnout has been like?
I've had conversations with people in a number of counties, and they've had conversations. Virtually everyone's had big turnout. But what we don't know is if that is a bunch of people who would have already voted or if it is instead expanding the electorate. Historically, the research tells us it does not really expand the electorate. It's people who have voted before. Based on the photos I've seen, they look like voters who have voted before. You know, I don't see a whole lot of young people standing in line who are looking to vote. So if you know what a voter looks like, I guess you can do that when you look at a photo. But you know, it's still good news that people are showing up early. I think there are also a fair number of voters who've realized the moment they vote, the phone calls to their house and to their cell phone, they stop. And so I think
is that right? They know that? They can track that?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. They know when you voted. It's a matter of record. And the moment you voted, if they knew you were one of their supporters or they knew you were persuadable, they can stop calling you because there's nothing else that can happen. So why call you other than to ask you for money or to come volunteer? And once you say no to that, they're not going to call back and ask again. So there are plenty of folks who realize this is the best way to get the phone calls and other things to text to stop.
That's a great tip. Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah. And in Marion County, I'll just say every day this week, we've seen lines around the city county building. It's the only place you can vote early right now, vote early in person right now. I suppose you could vote by mail at your home anytime. But yeah, the lines have been wrapped around the block. Even this morning, I saw some tweets about it, showing photos and saying that the lines weren't that bad. And judging by where that photo was taken, it was still a good block and a half away from the entrance to the clerk's office where you vote.
In Allen County, we actually moved the main early voting site from downtown from our used to call it City County building. We moved it from there out to the Coliseum. So it's actually in our arena, which provides much more space and allows people to, you know, there's far more parking, et cetera. So it's more convenient in some respects, but still the first day I know I heard from people who stood in line for 2.5 hours.
Clear this up for me. What are the chances at this point that Hoosiers who don't fall into the pre-existing rules for absentee voting will be able to vote by mail? Is that done?
I would say it's not good.
Slim to none, and slim is heading to the door, as somebody once said to me.
Plus, you're kind of running out of time at this point. Even if a court ruled that would be possible, your deadline to request a ballot by mail is October 22nd. So you've got a very short window of time. And for the most part, clerk's offices have said, if you're going to vote by mail, request it way before that October 22nd deadline.
So if you could both tell me, this would be interesting. What do you think we need to watch out for in the next month? Or what are you tracking in particular? What do you think, Andy?
You mean like, what's our October surprise?
If you're looking for one, sure. If you're looking for an October surprise, or you're tracking a particular demographic or any kind of trend, what is it that you expect to be looking at the most?
Normally, I would have either a race that I'm watching or something, but this is just such a weird year. It's hard for me to say that any one thing is the one thing that I think is most important to watch. And it sounds like I'm dodging the question, but it really is hard for me to figure that out. I mean, think about it. This is October 8th. We're having this conversation on October 8th. And this is not what October 8th normally feels like during a campaign at any level, local, state, or national. So it's hard for me to say. I think maybe part of what I'm wondering is how many campaigns further down on the ticket are suddenly deciding, wait a minute, maybe I can do a television buy because there's so little else going on. That will be interesting to me. If you suddenly have a bunch of state reps or senators who decide, you know what, I'm going to do 2 weeks worth of television, see if that does it for me. I'll keep an eye on that probably. Beyond that, though, I just keep my eyes open and watch what's going on.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in seeing what happens in the 5th District race. We've already seen those ads really throw some different accusations back and forth with the candidates, and I would thoroughly expect that to continue. So I'm curious to see what the new accusations will be come next week or the week after. Also, I think the thing that I'm the most curious about, which isn't really something we'll see happen, you know, over the next few weeks, but on election day, election night, how quick do we get results, or how slow do we get results, and when are races going to be called? And I don't think anyone really has a good answer to that question. So it's just the total unknown that we're going to go into come the beginning of November.
Up here, I have no reason to think this will be different for the fall, but the paper ballots were all counted, but they didn't even count them. They didn't do anything on election night. They dealt only with machines. All the paper stuff was put off till the next day. Now, we can begin to know whether races are close. If you look at the machine counts and Lindsay is ahead of me by 300 votes and there are only 200 paper ballots, well, I'm not winning no matter what happens with the paper ballots. But if she's ahead of me by 300 and there are 700 paper ballots, that'll be more interesting. And remember, that'll matter up and down the ballot. A lot of people will focus nationally on the presidential race or on the attorney general's race here or the 5th district. But start to think about, you know, a school board race or a county council race. And suddenly it's not 300 votes, it's, you know, 75 votes that makes the difference. So that's maybe going to be part of what's interesting in the days after the election for me. One thing I have pointed out to people though, is if you vote early, depending on the county you're in and the systems that are used, but in a lot of the counties where there's early voting, you actually are voting on a machine. You're not voting on a piece of paper, like if a ballot's mailed to you. And those machines will get counted on election night. So the folks who are trying to avoid being in a crowd on election day, but are willing to be around a smaller crowd, I point out, if you vote early, you know that's in the bank, that we'll know that on election night. And the people who are worried about what will happen when the paper ballots are getting counted a week later, you know, that's less of a concern for them. So it's something to think about when you're trying to decide which one of the ways to vote you're going to use.
Thank you so much for making time, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Andy Downs and Lindsay Erdody. As we mentioned, you can read Lindsay's story about Governor Holcomb's hits and misses from his first term in the latest issue of IBJ. And before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to draw your attention to a few other strong stories. Mickey Shuey examines how the Marion County Capital Improvement Board, which owns the Indiana Convention Center and Indianapolis's major sports venues, is planning for an extremely lean 2021, with its revenue reduced by a third. Also on the front page this week, John Russell examines the latest computer models for forecasting COVID-19 in Indiana. And Kirk Christian explains how the city of Fishers has been able to pull in an extra $4.7 million in tax revenue from a surprising source, the city of Carmel. Again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it's a lot easier to access all of IBJ's award-winning business content if you have a subscription. It works out to about $2 per week, which is pretty good for the amount of information that can help you make important decisions as you prepare for 2021, which can't get here fast enough. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbenner. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.